name, sir?
David Trotsky.
Okay, sir. Welcome to the Arizona Board of Executive Committee. And according to my records, the Honorable Mr. David Neal will be conducting your hearing at this time, sir. So if you just hold on, once he gets his paperwork together, he will be the lead for your hearing at this time, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir.
Yeah, we do need to make a phone call. Shall I go ahead and make the phone call while you're doing yours together, sir?
Okay.
We're going to make a phone call. Some inmates have their attorneys do all the talking, and some do a combination. So that's up to you and your attorney, okay?
Okay, thank you.
All right, so you're 40 years old now, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You're serving a life sentence for first-degree murder, which began May 17, 1994. There was no parole eligibility date listed, but you were certified for this hearing for record parole and after active discharge on December 17th, 2018. You accepted a plea agreement for the incident offense on March 8th, 1995. On January 19th, 1994, you were 16 years old. when you lured the 17-year-old victim to the Salt River Bottom, and you shot the victim with your fired shotgun. You buried the body, and it was discovered on April 29, 1994, and a subsequent investigation led to your arrest and conviction. A very good investigation, you said that you had planned murder for months, and that it was because of what the victim had done to you. You said that the victim held you at gunpoint while another man sodomized you. And you were, so that's why you planned murder. At one point, I guess you told your sister, among others, and you also took your sister to the river bottom and showed her the body. So does that sound fairly accurate as a summary of what went on? We'll discuss details as we go.
Yes, sir, it is.
Okay. All right, so it looks like you had a lot of trouble with the juvenile. But any of it was real severe, but you were in and out of problems. You claimed that you were growing marijuana, you lived mild. But since you've been in, you've had little discipline over the years, and you've only had one infraction since 2008, and that was a major for promoting prison contraband. You have excellent support system, extensive programming, and you have a good learning plan. So, sir, I'm going to leave it up to you and your attorney to determine, you know, which one of you is going to speak, or if your attorney would like to make a statement and we'll talk to you about what went on. So, would you like to address the board first, sir?
Yes, thank you.
State your name.
My name is Charlie Vogel, and I'm a volunteer lawyer with the Arizona Justice Project. Mm-hmm. When I talked to David about how this hearing might proceed, with the permission of the board, we decided that, with your permission, he would give you a brief overview of what he's thinking, and then I would speak for a few minutes on his behalf. I have Juliana Santavera here, who is prepared to talk about. She's a student at the Arizona State School of Social Work. She's getting her master's degree. I also have his stepfather here, who would like to address the court. But the plan that I'd like to have, if you are agreeable, is to have him speak briefly, and then I'll get up and speak, and we'll do that, and then you can follow up with questions with him. Acceptable?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Jamarski, so in that case, and typically we would go into this, been a lot of years since this happened, and you were quite young at the time, but can you kind of explain to the board what was going on in your life and your mind and what led to this?
Yes, sir. From a very young age, I had a lot of things that affected me deeply, made me a very angry young man. And when Jason and the other man, when they held me at gunpoint and they did what they did to me, it made me very, very angry on the inside. And I held on to that for a very long time. And then upon seeing him when he got out of jail, it came back to me, and that's when I took him out to the desert and I killed him. I have no justification for what I did other than being very angry at the time.
How old were you when that incident occurred? where they held you at gunpoint. How old were you?
I was 15, sir.
Okay, so somewhere a year, year and a half before you killed the victim.
Yes.
Okay.
I apologize, but the truth is that...
You need to come forward and state your name again, sir.
The truth is, if...
State your name again, I'm sorry.
Okay. My name is Charles Vogel.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Zaraski was 15 years old at the time of the crime. The victim, Jason Lee, was 16 years old at the time of the crime. I know he did not correct that, but he was 15, the victim was 16.
So Mr. Zaraski was 15 when he killed the victim?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you for that correction. At that point, at this point, what I'm trying to establish is how, because he said for a very long time, how, and I understand that 6 months can be a very long time. I'm just trying to establish how much prior to the murder that the other incident occurred.
And in fact, it was just about 6 months.
Okay,
all right, thank you.
Okay, so according to the information we have, you were, I think, back in the time, and what I read, it sounds to me like somebody that's got a lot of issues talking, and when they said some of the things that you made as statements to various witnesses and investigators, one of the things that what did catch my eye, were you actually growing marijuana at that time, or was that just something to make you look big in the eyes of your peers?
That was something I just wanted, I knew Jason might be interested in.
Okay, so, well, it was, of course I can see as far as learning the victim, that would be something that you might be interested in going and looking at. It's kind of a tough one. There's not a whole lot of issues about what happened and the timing and everything on it. The why this happened is the big question. And I can understand why it's not justification, but the reason that you decided to do this, I can understand that causing a lot of anger. It is a little bit over the top to plan to murder somebody for doing something like that. Did you think of any other things, like maybe contacting the police about that?
Sir, I didn't want anybody to know about it. At the time, it wasn't cool to be gay. It wasn't looked at as something that was positive. And I think I wrestled with my own sexuality at that time.
At that time, were you gay, or did you consider yourself gay, or?
I hadn't had sex with anyone, and so I was still trying to learn about myself.
Okay. But the reason I ask that, a lot of times, instances like what you were talking about with the rugby gunpoint and did that to you, a lot of times that comes from somebody rather angered or misplaced anger or whatever angst against somebody that is gay or, like race crimes and things like that. There was, the point of it, you because of the way you act or the way you are or something. That's why I wasn't asking you. But it sounds like you were younger and smaller than the other two.
Yes, sir, that was exactly right.
I don't think I have any questions right at this time, but I'm going to see if my fellow board members do. Who's with us?
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Zarowski, were you on probation at the time? I see in the past you had several probations. Were you on probation at the time of the incident?
Yes, I was, ma'am.
Okay. And what were your probations for? I see that you had a lot of them.
I first was put on probation for a burglary with the victim, Jason Lee. And then I was put on probation again for a joyriding and a marijuana possession.
Okay, I did see that one. Okay, so you and Jason, the victim, were, I don't know, partners in doing some criminal activity then?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Neal.
Mr. Gaines?
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Zarowski?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
I'm going to ask, I think, a series of questions for me, as one voting board member, to get an understanding of the case. But I want to be really careful about what may sound like justifications, especially in the face of victims' representatives. But it would seem that there was an event that caused a tremendous amount of anger in you leading up to the murder. And for understanding, was there any proof of this assault that you're talking about? And I have no use for anybody being assaulted, but if you were sexually assaulted, was there any proof of that sexual assault? Were there any witnesses that ever came out? It sounded like there was more than one individual that was involved in this assault, correct?
There was two people, and there was never any cooperation.
All I'm asking was there any proof of this sexual assault happening, if there was a surviving participant of the assault?
No, sir, there wasn't.
Okay. I'm not accusing you of not telling us the truth, but we still have to deal with legal matters. The second thing, and it's a concern of mine, is with you being so calculating in this murder, creating this ruse, if you will, about the marijuana, it raises a question for me as to what other ruses are at stake in this case. And it's something that I'm going to have to consider very strongly. I will look at the whole of your case, and I think it's fair to also point out to you that I personally am a big fan of current science, of keeping up with science, and there's been much discussion about the development of the juvenile mind and when an individual is considered completely mature. But I am weighing that against how calculating this crime was. So I am a bit concerned about the totality of the crime, if you will. We hear a large variety of cases here. They're all unique. But this one is certainly unique in its own right in terms of the planning, the death of the victim, and your state of mind during that crime. So I guess I'll just ask you, where are you at now? Psychologically, pardon me.
I have dealt with the addiction that I had at that time. Over the years, I've learned about myself and to deal with my anger better. And I've become like a peer mentor in the yard, and I've learned to help other people.
Thank you, Mr. Zarowski. At this point, I'm going to put a question.
Mr. Jones.
Mr. Zawoski, I know they asked you a couple of times, but why didn't you notify the police when you were sexually assaulted?
Sir, I didn't want anybody to know about this. I didn't want anybody saying that I was homosexual, and I didn't want to be looked at like I was involved in something that was gay or something like that.
Okay, so you waited for the victim to get out of, was he in juvenile or he was at detention or something else?
Pardon? I couldn't hear.
You waited for the victim to get out of detention or somewhere he was locked up for months?
It wasn't a matter of me waiting. Jason brought it up as he was laughing at me about it, and he brought it back up, and it brought it back. I didn't want anybody to know about it.
So you didn't want anybody to know about that, but you didn't mind telling your sister, your girlfriend, and your friends about you had murdered them?
After I murdered Jason, I felt like I was in a bit of a shock. I needed somebody to let me know that it was okay for what I had done. And this was me reaching out to my peers, people that were close to me, as a way of assuaging my own guilt.
So when you reached out to your peers, did you tell your peers at that time why you killed them?
No, sir, I still kept that from them.
So, did nobody ask you why did you do it?
I had a lot of different reasons why I told each one of the people that I took out there to the murder site.
And what were some of those reasons, sir?
I had said that, I was trying to get even with him for me being, me getting in trouble so many times, for me being on drugs, for him, him telling the other cops on me before, for me getting in trouble. I don't recall all of the different reasons, but I was trying to justify it in my own mind as well.
Okay, so your sister, I believe she was 13 years old, you told your sister. Is she the first one that you told?
Yes, sir, she was.
And what reason did you give your sister?
I don't exactly recall.
Okay. All right, thank you, sir.
Well, Mr. Lee, before I ask a question, may I see if I can connect this call again?
Okay.
And then I would like to ask questions, sir.
While we're waiting, could I ask a question? Good, go ahead. Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. So, Mr. Zawoski, I see that you participated in a victim impact panel.
Yes, sir, I did.
Is this Mr. Hiller for the hearing? For the parole?
Yeah.
Okay. If you can just hold on, sir. Yeah, the hearing is already going, and you will be called on at the appropriate time, sir. So just hold on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Zawoski. So you were saying it had an impact on you. Tell us what else happened with that.
I've taken the impact for crime and victims class twice, once in 2005 and once just recently. And both times, it was profound for me. And both times, it was in unique ways. This last time, it was probably because of being a bit more mature in my thinking, I was able to work with the mothers of murdered children. We did portraits of them, of the children. And, it was a uniquely, I felt like I was giving back a you know, there's something in my mind straight about the pain that I caused my homeowner's family.
So, and so you're an artist, so these are some of the, your art, I think, is attached to your packet.
Yes, ma'am, it is. I like to paint.
Okay, so this is your work here. Okay. All right, thank you, sir. Thank you. And sorry to ask a second question.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Mr. Neal. So, let me just ask this, and I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, I'm not a social worker, I'm none of those things where all these experts are participating. But in terms of, from your perspective, as you had these years to reflect on what happened, as you reflect from the time when you, let's say, was, I don't know, I'm just pulling this out of the air, 10 or 11 years old until you were 15 years old, how do you feel about your life up to that time? You were a young person, child to be exact, and I know you explained to the board that you didn't want to be considered as a homosexual, but what was going on in your life? You know, all of us have, you know, at all ages, but especially at that time, you know, we become a little more mature and begin to think. So what was going on in your mind, let's say, between, and I'm just pulling out at the beginning, between 9 or 10 and the time that the crime took place itself, sir?
I'm glad you asked, sir. I had a very awkward time for me growing up. I wasn't quite sure with my own body. I wasn't quite sure who I wanted to be. I was a very awkward child. I had awkward experiences with my peers, with my parents. And I had a hard time growing up. And I had a hard time with my parents, you know, with the way I was disciplined, and I had a hard time with being bullied as a child because I was awkward and smaller, and it created a lot of resentment and a lot of anger in my own heart and a lot of uncertainty about a lot of things.
So one of the reasons was that you were smaller. About how small were you in comparison with your peers at that time? You were shorter and less weight and so forth. Was that the case, sir?
Yes, sir. That's right.
Okay. Now, from your perspective, and I know some of this is just, would just be from your perspective, did you feel that your peers between that same age that I mentioned and the time of the offense itself, do you feel that your peers were participating in sexual activities and bragging about it, and you, as you say, you had not had sexual or any sexual intercourse or anything of that nature, so did that kind of make you feel kind of out of place, or what? I'm just trying to get a feel for who you were. That's what I'm really trying to do, sir.
I did make me feel very out of place. I wasn't quite sure, you know, who I was at that age. I knew that I liked girls, sir, and when people would call me names such as queerbait or fag, it really bothered me.
So you did have persons referring to you in what I would refer to in some negative ways. So that's and why do you believe that, to hear that, sir, that was part of what was going on?
Yes.
Now, you mentioned your parents. You said that they were, I'm not sure, I didn't write it down, but I believe that they were beating you or something. What was your real relationship with your parents, sir? As a child growing up, sir.
Well, my relationship with my parents was they always had higher expectations for me than I was able to attain with them. And when I would let them down, it created a friction between especially my father and myself. And he would discipline me very strongly, and it would create resentment within me.
Earlier you said you didn't mention your sister, but there any other kids in the family aside from you and your sister?
No, sir, there wasn't.
Okay, and how was your sister? Was she pretty, I don't mean scientifically, but was she pretty mature? Was she just a regular young person, as you saw at the time, sir?
Yeah, she was very normal.
Okay. And I think you've already answered this, but I'm just trying to get to know you a little better. And at what point did you actually decide in your own mind that you were going to commit this offense? I know you said that the young man, child, had been incarcerated and all of that or somewhere. So at what point did you decide, hey, I'm going to do this to get back at him for whatever reason you, in your mind, that you did it, sir? At what point did you make that decision, sir?
You know, I never really truly exercised the notion of killing him. It was more of a reactionary thing that happened right there out in the desert at the time. I wanted him to feel afraid and ashamed and upset at all the different emotions that I had felt, the anxieties that I had felt throughout the months prior to this day happening of the murder.
I'm sure you've already explained it, but it just didn't stick in my mind. Now, what were the two of you doing out in the desert, sir? Why were you out there, sir?
We went out. I told him that I had marijuana plants growing out there, and that I wanted to show him my dad's new shotgun.
And so the two of you just went out there and then you committed the offense, and is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir. Jason and I used to go out to the desert on a regular basis, so it wasn't anything all that out of the normal.
So when you committed the offense itself, your recollection, and some of this can be found in some of the documentation that we have, but I'm just trying to get it from you now. How did you shoot him? I mean, did you shoot him in the back? Did you shoot him in the front? Did you shoot him in the face? Well, how did you shoot him, sir?
I shot him from the front, and he fell forward. I thought at the time when he had the shovel that he thought that I was going to shoot him, and I thought he was going to swing the shovel at me. It was really something that it was more reactionary right at the time than anything else.
I want to leave that for a moment and then I'll turn it back over to you, Mr. Neal. But let me just move forward a little bit now. After being incarcerated, I guess I asked the question that I always ask. Why do you think that I should, as a board member, vote to release you, sir?
I've learned a lot of different things. I've learned a lot of trades. I've learned about myself. I've learned how to help other people. And I would like to continue that if I'm getting out. In a way, I've outgrown DOC, being in prison. I've taken multitudes of programs. I'm ready to go on to the next stage of my life.
And what is that next stage in your mind, sir?
I would like a career and a family, and to give back to my community through community projects, through helping other people, through helping youth that were in trouble just like me growing up.
So how would you do that? I know that you do some great artwork, and we appreciate you sharing that with the board. We've had an opportunity to see it. But what else would you do, sir, if you were released, if you were back out in society? You're still quite young, I mean, relatively speaking. I don't know if this is relative, you are young. So what do you see the future being, sir, if this board decided to release you, sir?
As opposed to with counseling others or a career or how do you mean, sir?
I mean both. Yes, what? Yes, sir. Career, counseling others. That's exactly what do you? What would you?
Oh, okay.
Do? How do you?
Okay,
mean, sir.
I would like a career in welding and steel fabrication. It's something that I do like here in prison. It's one of the trades that I've learned. I really enjoy doing it. And also, in my off time, I'm a peer mentor, and I like to work with people that have substance abuse problems, also young people. I do a little bit of that now here, and it's very gratifying. I feel like it gives back to me, and it helps me with my own sobriety. It helps me with my own state of mind. It's extremely rewarding for me. It's been one of the cornerstones of progressive and positive thought and my own maturity.
Okay, I can understand that. But back to the original offense itself, and they've just been asked, but it didn't ring a bell with me. You mentioned the fact that out there in that field that y'all had, that you was growing some marijuana plants or something. At that age, were you smoking it, or were you just growing it for the sale? What was going on with that marijuana stuff there?
Sir, I did all different kinds of drugs. I smoked marijuana. I did crystal meth. My substance use was one of the largest contributing factors to my state of mind, and the reason why I truly believe why I had such irrational thinking at the time.
And about what age did you start using illegal, what I would refer to as illegal substances, such as drugs? About what age did you start that, sir?
I was 14, sir.
14, okay. And you haven't used any since you've been incarcerated, sir?
No. I had my problems with drug use in prison. I've been sober for the past 5 years.
Okay, sir. Okay, this time I think I have some more questions, but I think for time management purposes, I'm going to stop at this time, Honorable Mr. Neal, and
thank you.
Turn it back to you, sir.
No other questions from the board? Okay, we have no other questions from the board, so, sir, if you'd like to address us now.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Charlie Vogel. I'm a lawyer who I've been practicing criminal law for about 25 years, and I'm volunteering now with the Arizona Justice Project. I know that you're familiar with the Arizona Justice Project. Most of these folks that are here today are from the Arizona Justice Project. They've taken on this idea that we would like to spend some time representing people.
Mr. Hanger?
Yes.
I don't know what you're doing, but you're causing a whole lot of noise here on this end. Okay, that's better. Thank you, sir.
Yep, sorry about that.
Anyway, the Arizona Justice Project is now starting to represent juveniles, people who were convicted when they were juveniles. And Mr. Quinones brought up earlier that he is very familiar with this science. I do not want to spend time going over things that you already know about immature juvenile brains. And I don't really want to go over these cases, the Supreme Court cases that say that somebody ought to have a reasonable opportunity for release based upon maturity and rehabilitation, demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. But that's what I'd like to talk to you about today, and that is this. There's no question, I mean, you just talked to David. What was going on, he was a mess as a 15-year-old boy. He was an absolute mess. He was small. He was bullied in school. He was very severely disciplined by his father, physically and emotionally. And so the question of brain immaturity at that time, I don't present that in any way as rationalization or as an excuse for the acts that he committed. I only say that 15-year-olds have underdeveloped brains, and so what does that mean for David Zarosky, who now is 40 years old? Has he changed? Has he matured? Has he been rehabilitated? Well, I will tell you that, when I met him back in March of last year, I went out to visit him. I've been to visit him 14 other times since. I've spent quite a bit of time out there at the East Unit, and I will tell you that I have watched him interact with the staff, the COs, and it is an amazingly respectful situation. He is well respected within that community, and I will tell you, the first time I saw him, he did not expect, he didn't know I was coming. And when he showed up to our meeting, his hands were dirty, he had grime on his face, and he was just coming from work, he's been working in the welding shop. One of the things that impressed me upon first meeting him is he not only works in DOC, he not only does his job, he stays busy all the time. And what he has learned, how he has evolved, how he has matured, is that he has learned that through asking others for help and staying positive in an environment that can be very negative, obviously, it's prison, he has created a protocol, a regimen, where he works, he goes to school, he does programming, he does peer mentoring, and he stays busy because he knows that staying busy is the thing that keeps him going, The first time I visited him, after our visit, we went outside and he said to me, "Look around. See that building? I put a roof on that building. You see that over there? I built these things where the air conditioners are sitting." And in fact, the last time I saw him was about a week ago. He was actually quite enthusiastic about the fact that he's been working on a wheelchair ramp for the mess hall. And because of his training, as you can see, I did send in a parole packet, and I hope you all had a chance to look at it. It includes information about his past. It also includes certificates and transcripts from his schooling. And of course, it includes his art. The point is, he has gone out of his way to get an education since he's been in the Department of Corrections. He's gotten various certificates which have helped him in this facilities management that he is currently working in. He's competent in electrical work, he's competent in drywall and framing and welding and air conditioning, all sorts of things. He has not languished in prison. He has done his work, and it is the constant evolution and discovery on his part that I would like to impress upon you all, because he is not a 15-year-old boy anymore who did these things that you've asked him about today. That's not who he is. He is a person in the yard who is looked to by the staff to take on projects. And in fact, one of the things he learned in school, he pointed this out to me when I met with him one time, is that he's a very good blueprint reader. And what that does, in addition to these other skills, is it allows him, when the staff say to him, "We need for you to," and I'll just use this example of the ramp, "We need for you to build this ramp." They don't need anybody else. He can design it. And he goes to the code, and he makes sure it's in compliance with the American with Disabilities Act. And they look to him to do these things. On one occasion, David was being transferred from one part of the prison to another, and they went into a little holding area. It was the middle of the summer. This wasn't too long ago, and it was hot. And he said to the CO that was transporting him, "Boy, it sure is hot in here. We ought to get a, would be nice if we got a cooler." The CO went to his superior, and before long they just said, why don't you acquire a cooler and put it in there? The point I'm making is that he has grown into a mature adult who is relied upon by those people in the Department of Corrections. And I think that that's an important thing. The other thing I want to point out that David talked about a little bit is his peer mentoring. He has done a great deal of work in this peer mentoring. He's not only done peer mentoring in the construction trades, but he's also done it for the Arizona Department of Health and Human Services, where he has taught other inmates about various diseases and worked on that particular program. And as you can see from his artwork, he's extremely proud of the artwork that he has done and the work that he has done. And he has done mentoring with respect to his artwork as well. He's done several in the visitation room at Florence East. He has done these murals. They're great. I mean, they are. It's a good thing to have them there. He has mentored others in that. He's participated in this program called Incarcerated, which is run through ASU. And what they do is they take artwork from prisoners, and they auctioned it off, and they give the money to charity. Well, they've only had one auction so far, and that was in 2017. It raised about $7,000, and all the money went to the Arizona Children's Center for Cancer or something like that. I apologize for not knowing exactly what that was. I have never seen. I do want to say that he also has participated in something called the Relay for Life, which is a charitable fundraiser out at Florence East. He has been on that committee with COs. There are COs on the committee and there are inmates on the committee. He's been on that committee for about 5 years, and they raise money for the Arizona, for the American Cancer Society. I would like to tell you about when I first went to see David. He did not have in his possession various documents because he never got them. His attorney, when he was, and I'm not blaming anybody, but he did not have a possession of the pre-sentence report. He did not have possession of any of the sentencing documents. He did not have. And he had never read the letter that was submitted to the court by the victim, Jason Lee's mother, Joni Lee. And he had never read that before. And I left that paperwork with him. The next time I returned to visit him, he was devastated by the recognition of the pain that he had caused, and it was very moving for him to have finally read that letter. And what he said to me was, I wish a long time ago that I could speak with his mother. And I, of course, informed him that victims' rights precluded him from contacting any of the victims and that he could not do that. I do know that the Department of Corrections is implementing a new policy that goes into effect March 1st. It is DOC Department Order 526, and it is a program promoting restorative justice, and they have a whole section in there about victim-offender dialogue. But again, that is a program that requires that it be initiated by the victim and not at all by the offender. What I'd like to leave you with is this. This was a horrible crime, and David knows that. And he is very remorseful for it. He is sorry, and he feels, of course, responsible. And he takes absolute responsibility for it. He's not denying responsibility. But the law says that he is entitled to a hearing where he has a meaningful opportunity for release based upon a demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. I think that if you look at the packet that I sent in and you listen to what he has done exactly that. He has matured and he has been rehabilitated. He has always asked for help. I don't want to say he's always asked for help because, quite frankly, when he was first in prison, he didn't ask for help. When he was first in prison, it was hard for him. It was very hard for him to reconcile being in prison. But later on, he discovered that in order to improve himself and be better for his community, he needed to seek out assistance. And he did just that on many, many occasions. And he has participated. There are 42 pages of certificates, and they're all in there, and they're for good things that he's done. I ask you to consider. He's got a release plan. I'm going to ask Juliana Santavera to come up and talk to you a little bit about the release program, and then I'm going to ask David Rodriguez, who is his stepfather, is here. His release plan is, if he should be fortunate enough to get released, he could live with his mother and his stepfather. And I would like for David to have a chance to say a few words as well. Any of you have questions of me? Juliana. Thank you.
We have a message that was passed for our guests, and I'm also going to ask if we can take a break. If I can make this announcement, maybe take a 5-minute recess.
Okay. We'll take a 5-minute recess.
Okay. For all our guests, we received notification that there's a poor white Cadillac parked in Executive Reserve parking spot that needs to be moved. So I don't know if that's anybody in this room. I think there was just a concern. Pardon me, sir, with all due respect. I guess it needs to be moved. Thank you.
We'll take a 5-minute recess while we are.
Thank you, sir.
We're both worth it. So we'll come back at 10:30, so it'll be about 7 minutes. You're back.